unfortunately, so I'm here to welcome you. I want to first mention that this is a very auspicious day for the city. Earlier today, we closed escrow on this, so I am officially able to welcome you to our city hall here in Goleta. So, I want to thank you for all being here and for your interest in this very important community issue. And I want to especially thank Jennifer Lucchesi and the staff from the State Lands Commission to talk about the abandonment and the decommissioning of Platform Holly and Piers 421. And I also want to thank our staff, Ann Wells, and other staff that have been working on this as well as other agencies. And I know there are many, and I think Jennifer will go through that list. So thank you very much, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you. And good evening, and thank you all for spending your evening with us. It's an honor, and we're grateful that you're so interested in the work that we're doing out at Platform Holly and Piers 421. So thank you for being interested, asking really great questions, and coming to these town halls that we've been holding three or four times a year for the last couple years. We are at an extremely critical stage in the decommissioning of Platform Holly, which is very exciting for all of us. We are we have started the actual plugging and abandonment of the wells out at Platform Holly, and Jeff will talk about the details of all of that. We have also, in the last couple months, finished the plugging and abandonment of Piers 421, the production well, as well. So the next step with regards to the shore zone piers is to move forward with our CEQA compliance and look towards the removal of those piers from the shore zone. So like I said, we've made significant progress over the last couple years on this project. We are at the critical stage of plugging and abandoning the wells on Platform Holly, and that's why we're here tonight, is to talk about that work and what's going to be expected over the next couple months to the next couple of years. But before I begin, or before I hand it over to Jeff to go through the details of Platform Holly and the 421 work, I do want to express my deepest gratitude to the Mayor Pro Tem, Mayor Perotti, Goleta City Council, City Manager Michelle Green, and Wells, and the entire city for not only hosting us at these town halls over the last couple years, but for their really collaborative partnership as we work towards this important project. This has become a second home to us of sorts, and so we are deeply invested in this community and the work that we're doing in, offshore to really enhance the city of Goleta and the county of Santa Barbara. I also want to acknowledge and thank the state and local government, other local governments that we're working with. We have OSPR represented tonight here. We have, I don't see folks from Dogger, but they're usually here, and we're, oh, there you are. Hi, oh, Pat. So Dogger, Santa Barbara County APCD, the Coast Guard, all of these agencies have been extremely helpful and supportive in our work. This is a state public works project, essentially, and so it really takes all of us agencies to make sure it's as successful and safe as possible, and so we're very thankful for that partnership. And finally, for those that may have come early, we were meeting with our tribal nations, our tribal communities in this area, talking through our next steps at Platform Holly, talking through how we might be able to better communicate, coordinate, and ensure that their tribal cultural resources are protected both in the process of plugging and abandonment, but in the case of a spill. And so I also want to express my deepest gratitude to our tribal nations for your engagement, your time, your insight, and your resource in helping us do our jobs better. So with that, I'm going to do that at the end. Okay. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to jump right into the details that you all want to hear about tonight.
Good evening. Good evening, and Welcome to what I believe is our fifth town hall here in Goleta. On the decommissioning of the Venico wells and the infrastructure they left us. Since our last meeting in June, we've completed the removal of all the non-essential equipment and materials from the platform, refurbished or replaced virtually the entire drilling equipment on the platform, which is required for the plug and abandonment. I call it a drilling rig and drilling equipment. We're not doing any drilling, but it's the same equipment that's used to end the life of these wells as it is to start the life of the wells. Other service provider equipment, such as a cementing unit, wireline unit, logging units, coiled tubing, they've all been moved onto the platform, which I'll show you in a little bit. The electric supply of the platform, its equipment's been reviewed and a realignment completed. The generators now are available and been repurposed to as a backup in case there's a shutdown of the electricity to the platform. And we've also replaced the fire pump water and a few other lines to get what we need out and onto the platform in order to do the plugging and abandonment work. This is what the new Holly looks like, if you've seen the old one. All the storage tanks there on the right, they've all been replaced by the various equipment I just talked about that we use to abandon the wells. The heliport's been cut in half and is now just an area where the crane boom can rest whenever we're inspecting or repairing the crane. You can see the new office modules and on the side underneath the top deck there that we replaced last fall. And there's a bunch of new equipment up on that drill deck, which I'll get into here in a few minutes, actually, right now. Over 115,000 man hours have been put into bringing Platform Holly up to the status we need in order to do the work. The pictures on the left are some of the pictures of the old Holly and the rust bucket that you see there. And on the right are some of the new pictures and new equipment. I like having the pictures because they explain things a lot better than I can. One of the more stunning changes here, that almost vertical pad, if you will, coming off the drill floor, called the V-door, is where the pipe was either picked up and put up onto the drilling deck or taken out of the well and put down there for waiting for the platform crane to either move it off or on. The picture on the right shows what that area looks like today, and you can see that vertical pad now is horizontal, and just to the left, that little red thing I'll show you a little bit better is called a knuckle boom crane, which has the ability to pick up the pipe and place it right down on the deck for a lot easier removal onto the rather large ship they brought in from the Gulf. This is a better picture of the new crane. You can see it picking up a 30-foot joint of pipe there and taking it up off the drill floor and placing it down on the pipe racks down on the deck below. And then from there, the pipe can then be bundled and put onto the work boat that they did bring out from the Gulf. We use the term safety a lot, and not without reason. This is a partial list of some of the safety and response plans. Some are required by regulations, other are required by the American Petroleum Institute recommended practices, and or our worldwide safe operating manuals for oil field practices. Safety really is the first and primary job for all of us working out on this project. There are safety meetings by each crew when they come out and when they leave. There's basically two towers, if you will, two groups of men that go in and out to do the work. They work 12-hour shifts. And when one comes off, they talk to the one coming on. Everything is shut down. They have a safety meeting, and then people leave and people start to work. One of the other things that's really unique, I think, here is that anyone working out on the platform has the ability to shut down the operation if they see something that they feel is not safe, including the cook. I mean, anybody who sees something that doesn't look right, they can immediately shut down the operation and bring it to the attention of the person in charge, either of the rig or the Beacon West person who's out there who's in charge of the actual platform. There's a morning report sent out every morning around 6 a.m. to describe in detail the 24-hour operation that has gone on. Not only I, but a number of the state lands engineers review those every day. In addition, there's a weekly summary that I put out for my management and others. And there's many eyes on this operation, including everyone in this room tonight. And we're well aware of the safety of everyone involved in these operations, the community, and the environment. And we know that that's paramount to keeping everything safe, to completing our work. So, the big news is that on 6 a.m. on Halloween, we finally got rigged up on Holly over the first well that's to be abandoned. acronyms and stuff here, but we actually rigged up what's called a coil tubing unit and the blowout prevention equipment that's used by that particular unit. There's two main phases of the plugging that are going to be done. The first phase is looking at 12 or 16 wells that the engineers have found would be good candidates for using the coil tubing to abandon the production interval. The production interval is the geologic formation, if you will, that produces the oil, okay, at the bottom of the well. And what they're going to do is they use the coil tubing it's a continuous line of flexible tubing, and they can run it down inside the production tubing itself. The coil tubing is anywhere from 1.25 inches to 1.5 inches. You can run this down to the bottom of the well. What's going to happen is that they're going to use this not only to clean out some of the stuff in the tubular itself, but to pump cement down across the production formation, which out here is the Monterey formation. Once we've cemented off the production zone in these wells, then we'll bring the full rig to bear to complete the abandonment of the well. In other words, put cement all the way from the production interval up to the surface of the up to the top of the wellbore at the mud at the seafloor. What this enables us to do is, once we've got the production and formation sealed off, there's no further ability for it to flow through the pipe, through the casing, through the production. And it makes it a much safer well to work on later when we bring the rig in. The other wells, as you may know, there's 30 wells out there. The other 15 or so wells will be abandoned using the drilling rig and the conventional methods. In other words, not using the coil tubing. Now the EIR, no, this is it. The EIR for the removal or any potential repurposing of the platform, as we know, should be may start somewheres in the fourth quarter of 2020, sometime the end of next year. That'll be a multi-year process and include a lot of scoping and a lot of public involvement. I got it. As far as the Elwood Onshore facility, there's nothing new to report. It's still there. Franco is still dead. So it's just really there to make sure that we get electricity, some pilot light gas out, and treat some of the gas that is coming off the platform and has been coming off the platform all these years on shore. I really don't have anything to say about it, but Seth may have some updates on where it sits in the bankruptcy court.
I was going to say, it's nothing too terribly exciting. We did have a hearing in late August in front of the Delaware District Court. So we were in the Delaware Bankruptcy Court over an inverse condemnation claim that Vinico made against us for taking their property and using it to decommission Platform Holly, the job that it was built for. Long story short, we took this out on an appeal to the District Court of Delaware on sovereign immunity issues, among other items, and that, like I said, that hearing was in August, late August. We don't actually anticipate a final resolution of that lawsuit or a final order from the judge until the new year. He mentioned to us that he was approximately 600 cases deep and that he would be trudging through them. So he basically said, don't expect a decision before the beginning of this next year. So it is a little bit of a sit tight, depending on what happens here. There's a couple of different outcomes. If we are successful and the case is dismissed on the grounds of sovereign immunity, the trustee for Vinico has one of two choices. They can go away, which won't happen. The other side of that is they can file for an attempted claim for inverse condemnation in the state of California, which would have been appropriate. If we lose, the commission and our outside counsel have already committed to continuing to fight this into the Third Circuit based on what we think are very good grounds for success. But basically, we are contesting the conception that the trustee has that we have inversely condemned their land, given that the obligation that they owe the state and the county and everyone else was to decommission these facilities. We're not doing it for just, fun and giggles or for an expansion of a public right-of-way. We're doing it because that was something they were obligated to do in the first place. So we have quite a ways to go before this is done, and it has been quite litigious, and I assume it will continue to be so. But to that same point, the commission and its contractors remain on the EOF. We operate the EOF. We maintain the safety and regulatory compliance. Like Jeff said, we continue to work with all of the permitting bodies to make sure that the small amounts of gas that do come across on the platform to the shoreside are treated so that the community is covered. And actually, it might be a good time we can mention that. Just so folks know, because this is timely, the Elwood Onshore does regular testing and drills, and there will be an Elwood annual emergency siren test coming up November 12th. This is to test the sirens associated with the hydrogen sulfide detection system. So if you hear a siren at approximately 9:30 a.m. at November 12th, it is because this is a test of the system with the Santa Barbara County Fire Department in coordination with Beacon West, our operator at EOF. So with that, as Jeff said, the EOF is still there. We're manning it, we're maintaining it, and we are continuing to provide the regulatory compliance.
Okay. Thanks, Seth. The 420 wells are finally fully plugged and abandoned. Now, I could quit here if y'all want, but I guess you'd like to hear how that all happened and hear about what's going to happen with these eyesores. So. And I don't think Jennifer let me get away with this. Okay, so as y'all know, there was a release of oil inside and outside of the number two well caisson on May 28th. A response effort complete with a unified command headed up by Christian Carbo sitting over there in the corner attacked the oil, and the cleanup operations were completed in about 6 days. The oil inside of the number two well, I mean, I'm sorry, the soil inside the number two well caisson was cored. That is, that sections of the soil were removed for analysis by a common apparatus used to do that. There was no free oil flowing, no free flowing oil found in the caisson, but a lot of the samples were oiled soil. The team also took advantage of a low, low tide to excavate the sand on the beach next to the caisson while we could get there below the normal low tide line. And after they cleared off the sand and hit the bedrock, which here is the Monterey Formation, which is the same formation I just talked about that's producing offshore, when they hit the bedrock, Monterey producing Monterey Formation, a small stream of oil was released from the rock, apparently from one, probably from one of the natural fractures. It was cleaned up immediately, and no further expression of oil was noticed either inside or outside of the caisson. The tide rolled back in and covered up the hole we had made. With this knowledge, a plan was developed by the engineering and response teams. Just to reiterate, the wells were successfully, this well was successfully plugged and abandoned on September 14th, and the location was cleared. So here's the rest of the story. The original expression of oil occurred after a minor pressuring of the well. I'll show you a cartoon in a minute to explain this a little bit better to you. But and we also knew that the wells were tidal influenced, and that there's likely a connection to a natural fracture system in the Monterey, which has a lot of fractures, based on the excavation we did. So this led to the plan. And the main purpose of the plan was, one, not to induce any undue pressure onto the wellbore, keep it minimized as much as possible so that only enough to accomplish whatever we were trying to do. And critical operations, that is, anything that could apply pressure to the well, such as cementing, cutting, pulling pipe, circulating mud, was only to be done at low, low tide. In the event there was another expression of oil. This meant that the entire operation that we did that week took place between 10:30 at night and 4:30 in the morning, because that's when low, low tide was. So this it was basically a 24-hour operation. So prior to commencing any critical operation, we wanted to deploy the equipment and the personnel to respond to any expression of oil that we might get. That included excavating and building an earthen berm around, or a dam, if you will, around where we found that fracture, placing a vacuum hose from a vacuum truck that was stationed nearby into the bermed area in case we needed to suck up any water oil that may show up, and to deploy spill booms around the berm. Here's some pictures of what that looks like. This is where we're building the berm, and you can see that the boom is being placed all around the berm, as well as all the foremen standing around watching it. This next picture shows some of the boom deployed around the caisson, and it's also a pretty nice shot of the amount of backup we had, all the trucks on the road there that were there strictly in case we had a another expression of oil.
Jeff, can we follow up on that just a little? I would just like to tell everyone, one of the things that we did as a purely precautionary measure was we reestablished unified command. We worked with Dogger, with the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Oil Spill Prevention Response Group, as well as Patriot and a variety of other responders who would normally come out in a spill, and instead of assuming that there wouldn't be one, we were prepared in advance for even a very small reaction above and beyond even the berms and everything else. So we pre-stationed everyone, and we were very proactive about establishing a safety protocol that I don't think is necessarily used in all circumstances. And so this was kind of a learning tool for all of us in terms of deploying this and making sure that we were really, you know, enhancing the safety for the immediate beach and for the community. And it was very important to us to make sure that that was something that we did, and we were communicating across the breadth of the regulatory community. And there was a really great synergy about that that ended up making what we thought, you know, could have been a problem really be very smooth. And there wasn't anything that we ended up having to worry about, but we were prepared for something that could be very bad.
It's easier for me to go over and point at this stuff alone. I don't know if it'll... way the well was left when we had the extraction of oil, okay? The production zone being down here, all this gray area is cement that was put into the well. Hope you can hear me back there. And these little red areas are where we put holes into the pipe and cemented behind the pipe. Fresh water up here. So we basically had cement from the bottom of the well up to about 1,540. Okay? And it was at this point where we had that expression of oil. Give you an idea, just so you understand what I'm talking about, since most of you are familiar with this. The casing is a steel pipe down the ground. So if we were looking down at the well, the casing is meant to hold the formation out of the hole that we're trying to. Okay, and as we go down, you put smaller and smaller pieces of casing around to hold the formation back. So what we had in this well was a 20-inch outer diameter casing, okay? And inside that was, inside of that we had a 13.3-8 inch. Okay, with, and when I talk about the annulus of the casing, talking about the space in between. Basically, most of what I'm going to be talking about is the space. Some of it's filled with cement, and some of it isn't. Good idea, the 20-inch casing here, 13.3-8 was set down around 2000. And the 9 inches goes all the way to the bottom of the well and already all the way up to the surface.
I hope that helped. Okay, so the plan. So the engineering team determined that we should put three 100-foot cement plugs between that 9-inch and 13.3-8-inch casing, and that should be sufficient to seal off the annulus between those two pieces of casing. We determined where we would set the perforations, and we placed cement into the 9-inch casing and just allowed it by the weight of the cement to settle down and go out through the holes that we had put in the 9-inch casing. The result of the three annular plugs, the first plug was done just as we planned it with no oil to the surface. The second plug was going along fine, but at the end where we were circulating out some water around, there was a little bit of oil that came to the surface with the equipment. That made us nervous for the rest of the time. The third plug was just the same as the first one. There was no oil or strange water coming to the surface. So we got all three of those plugs set in that annular space. Then came to the surface plug. What we did is we went in and cut the 9-inch casing at about 450 feet, which is about 20 feet below where you saw the bottom of the 20-inch casing. On top of that cut pipe, we put a cast iron bridge plug, which effectively sealed that 9-inch casing and the 9 by 13.3-8 inch annular space. Then we ran logs to determine the integrity of the 13.3-8. The logs were indeterminate, but they did show a number of highly corroded areas in the pipe, which may or may not have been holes, okay? Just to show you what this all looks like, on the left, we had to put a new riser, which is the pipe that goes from around where the beach is up to where the drilling rig floor is, because it was too small to bring the 9-inch pipe up. The second picture there in the middle is pulling that 9-inch casing out of the hole. And as you can see in the third picture there, all that casing was wrapped in plastic and put over alongside of the rig and then taken off to a
disposal site.
A disposal site. Okay, so what we did is we decided we'd do cementing in two stages. While we were doing that, we also determined to keep all of our response equipment on scene and ready in case we saw anything on the beach. We did the same thing. We built the berms. We had the vac truck. We had the personnel on site. Everything was surrounded by the booms. And we put the first stage of cement from that bridge plug, the top of the 9-inch, up into the 13 and 3/8 inch casing. What happened was about halfway through the job, we actually saw some water and a small amount of oil come up in that area that we had bermed off. It was about a cup of oil. So, you know, it wasn't a lot, but it was oil. That was recovered immediately by the, not only by the crew, but basically by the vac truck. We went in the next morning, tagged the top of the cement at 285 feet. We had theoretically, the top of that cement should have been at 100 feet. So there was a lot of cement that had found its way out into whatever it was that was leaking, okay? I might say at this point in the well, we saw no further fluid from the well and no further pressure from the well. We figured it was dead. So the second stage was put on top of that, and when we ran in the hole the next day, it was exactly where we theoretically was supposed to be, at about 35 feet, which is just above beach level. The well was fully plugged with cement. No pressure or fluids were observed, and the well was dead. So here's the obligatory before and after diagrams, just to give you an idea. You can see what it looked like when I was up there showing you the way we started, and you can see the amount of cement that was put in the well during our operation. Those big red blobs, those are the 100-foot sections of cement where we perfed the casing, and the cement flowed out in between that annular space. And this is what's left out there today. The two wellheads are still on there just for observation to see if there's, you know, any pressure or anything. We haven't seen anything to date. And this is what the CEQA determination will make next year, hopefully. And we'll have to clear out all of that soil that's in there, take the wellheads off, and take the piers and the caissons out.
And I'll just add, we're working on the development of the decommissioning plan for the piers independently of the rest of Platform Holly. So this will actually be the CEQA treatment for the 421 decommissioning of the piers will be well in advance of the EIR for Platform Holly. So the CEQA treatment that we're doing on this is we are assessing the final removal plan, and it will either fall within the confines of a prior EIR, or it will be a supplemental. Right. And if it is in the confines of the prior, we may do an addendum for an updated statement so everyone knows what the differences are, but why there aren't any significant impacts. If there are significant impacts determined, we will be doing a supplemental EIR that's very streamlined, focused on the removal of the second pier in particular and some of the infrastructure associated with that. So that will be forthcoming, probably actually. Determination on that will be forthcoming the beginning of this next year, I would say January for sure. And depending on the action, it could be very quick that we move into an approval phase from the commission. And then once the plan is set, working with our contractors and everybody else to start the physical decommissioning of that property. So that's an exciting component to this at the same time that we're finally undertaking the beginning of the plug and abandonment of Platform Holly. So the big steps and the milestones are starting, and I think that's something that I'm very excited to announce here because we've been hoping for that for the last year and a half. So,
all right. So that concludes our formal presentation. As with prior town halls, we invite folks to come up and ask questions, make comments, that sort of thing. We don't have this time around our speaker cards, so I'm going to ask everybody to be respectful and come up one at a time, state your name, and so that we can keep track and we can hopefully answer your questions or address your comments. But before I open up the podium, I did forget to introduce our team here, so I'm very sorry. So Jeff Plank is our project co-lead and senior engineer and retired annuitant with the State Lands Commission. Seth Blackman is our senior attorney and other project co-lead on this decommissioning project. Steve Kern is our senior engineer that's working both on Platform Holly decommissioning as well as the Rincon Island decommissioning, and he's also the lead on our Legacy Well remediation program, primarily focused on offshore Summerlin, but encompasses a much larger area. And then in the back somewhere, I think she just may have stepped out, is Jennifer Maddox. Oh, there she is. Jennifer is the Commission Science Policy Advisor and Tribal Liaison. So with that, I invite folks to come on up to the podium and ask questions, and hopefully we can answer them.
Yep. Hi, my name is Carla Frisk. I'm here representing Get Oil Out tonight. Thank you so much for a great presentation, and I love those PowerPoints. Mainly, I just have wanted to see if we could get a little idea of where we are on the funding for this. I know that there was a $22 million bond, and I suspect that's gone, mostly gone. And then what is the difference covered by the state and versus ExxonMobil?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the $22 million bond was in addition to $58.5 million that was made available by the California State Legislature. So we're all enjoying paying for this. So there's a total of $80 million that has been set aside for costs for the state of California. Projections are still within that parameter. The cost estimates right now for the work being done by ExxonMobil on this across a huge swath of the work that they're doing is going to be, by the time this is done, about $305 million plus. And so that's broken down between both the plug and abandonment phase, including significant repairs that have happened to date, rebuilding the rig, rebuilding, as Jeff said, sort of the new Holly top, bringing in all the appropriate equipment and repurposing Platform Holly for the abandonment work. And then so it's about a 50-50 split, maybe a little bit more on the decommissioning side. But that is still the breakdown there. They have fulfilled their obligations. And just so everyone knows, I'm actually in the process of working with ExxonMobil's counsel to finalize the kind of phase two decommissioning agreement that will, once it's done, will be up on our website and everybody can access it and look at it. And it's there's already a commitment letter that's in place for all of this, but we've been going through this in phases to make sure everything sort of flows and doesn't trip over each other. So this next one is going to be very important just from our perspective.
So the $58 million, I always got the impression that somehow that was the $22 million, and then ExxonMobil had to pick up the balance. So where does the 58 and that, except for the EOF, which. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We don't know it. But that's the $58 million is not for the EOF. Is that correct?
Correct. The $58 million is not for the EOF. There
so
is not,
what is that specifically for that ExxonMobil?
So the $58 million plus the $22 million is two things. There are operations and maintenance that the state of California has picked up as a result of basically when Vinico left the premises that we needed to maintain. So this goes back. These costs go all the way back to the initial transitional kind of services agreement that occurred, I think it was May 1st of 2017, all the way through September 15th, 2017, where we were having to deal with that. And then it deals with staffing and maintenance, both on Holly and on Elwood Onshore Facility, big picture. So that is embedded in those costs. The other part of this that we have prepared for is that we are covering a portion of seven wells on Platform Holly that were redrilled by Vinico. And so those are, there's a percentage breakdown between Exxon's cost on that and our cost, but those are because and we don't have to get into all the specifics, and I'll happily go into more about that, but it's a shared cost on those. And there are other costs that we have encountered that are shared costs because of the way that the breakdown has worked, but that is the kind of the reality. And this is something actually that Bessie is dealing with right now with Gail and Grace and Chevron as well, very similar issues. So there are limitations on what we were able to go after, both legally and otherwise. So we were able to strike this in a way that was beneficial, but there is definitely still a cost to the state.
So there's, and then that cost is never going to get reimbursed.
Right. That's absolutely right. And, you know, we've looked at alternative options, but again, Vinico was kind of a singularly owned entity, and so there isn't anyone else to go to at this point. We're stuck with an insolvent, you know, now trustee or debtor that had come out of the prior bankruptcy. So, yeah, and this is actually reason for some recent legislation that has been passed to start adding criminal penalties for people who walk out, for companies that walk out on their obligations. The State Lands Commission worked with Senator Lamone and others to pass this legislation so we can start adding criminal measures to this, which if you go into bankruptcy and you avoid the civil element, we can still pursue criminal penalty, which it's a start. It's not perfect, but we're working on it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Robert Perry. I'm with the World Business Academy, and I'm new to this. This is my first meeting. I have to say, I want to commend you on the thoroughness and diligence with respect to the operations reflected in the presentation. I think we can all look forward to having these structures removed and having the beach restored to its original condition. I will be continuing to attend meetings because I am very interested in the repurposing aspect of that's going to commence at the end of next year. And I think given that Platform Holly is a state asset now, I think we all need to be very, approach it unemotionally and look at, you know, the positive applications that that the structure can provide to the state and the community, and make sure that the marine habitat that has flourished underneath the structure is maintained. So thank you. And good work. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Hi there. My name is Ryan Davis. I'm a former marine and planetary science researcher. And my first semester at UC Berkeley, I confirmed a world-changing solar energy discovery that creates clean water and sustainable sellable electricity from lightning. While we don't have a lot of lightning here in this area, in other places where there are platforms, there is lightning. So we think we have a great research opportunity with some of the old platforms. Might even help us recycle sea plastic. And I can get into that another time. But essentially, we know that the platforms have the potential to draw a charge. We saw some examples of the columns. Those can be thought of as electrical terminals that can move magnets. And if they can move magnets, they can create clean energy for us. And that can turn this area into a proof of concept that will metamorph some of the old infrastructure into something that's going to change the world and help fight global warming. So I'm one of those systems. I'm something called ProjectFirstLight.net. And I'm interested in working with the city and the state on ways to repurpose the infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. You'll hear us talk about this a number of times throughout the night. As we mentioned in the presentation, we're going to start scoping out the future disposition of the platform at the end of next year or the beginning of 2021. And so it's really important for us in our jobs as we scope out what that may look like, whether it's, you know, along the entire spectrum, full removal to full repurposing, that we hear from the community, we hear from stakeholders about what those ideas are, and so that we can include them in our analysis, both from an environmental impact perspective, but also a technical, feasible, and economic impact. So we hope that you continue to keep track of what we're doing, continue to keep tabs on our website, and of course we'll obviously be down here many, many times to talk about the evolution of that process. But you can be assured that it will be anchored in a very robust and comprehensive public engagement throughout the CEQA process, and then also throughout the Commission's decision on this. We're not a typical regulatory agency. Our commission makes decisions in at public meetings, very similar to the way city councils or board of supervisors make decisions. And so there will be numerous opportunities, not just to talk with staff and help inform our analysis and development of the EIR, but also to actually talk and testify directly to our commissioners about what your ideas and preferences are. So I really encourage you to stay engaged with us and our commission. So with that, don't be shy.
Yeah, I have a comment for Jeff. My name is Jeff Mawson as well. I'm a local commercial fisherman. I dive for sea urchins. But aside from that, I understood in your one of your slides, Jeff, that you had said that there was a loss of concrete, possibly through a protrusion in the casing, and that you had expected that it would have filled it up to a certain level and you had to use extra. And I was just wondering if you took any soundings on the area immediately surrounding the primary casing to see what kind of a cross-section or a break there was in the casing. And if you think that the amount that was, the extra amount of concrete to backfill that was sufficient to stop any further oil leaks.
We didn't lose the concrete or cement, as we call it. And no, we didn't take any soundings. Okay, so once the cement sets up, I mean, there's very little you can do, you know, getting through it or anything. We are confident that we have cemented not only the annular spaces and nothing is ever coming up from the bottom, but also that top. The reason that we cut the 9-inch below that. The bottom of the 20-inch was so that it would kind of filter out into that area. If, in fact, if the hypothesis that it was a natural fracture somehow interacting with some oil that had been retained in that annular space, we're confident that the cement that was placed out there filled the, whatever that void was in that particular area. It was a lot of cement that we put in there and just kind of filtered out. The fact that we didn't, one of the interesting things is the fact that we've only got, in all the operations that we did that week, we only got about a cup of oil, is an indication as well that potentially that the oil that we saw in May was all the oil that was in there. And that was connected to whatever brought it to the surface. But no, we didn't do any soundings.
From an engineering standpoint, how many extra cubic yards did you have to add to the casing to make a seal?
I don't have the numbers with me.
Okay, cool.
Any idea?
We think in terms of barrels, but probably pushed out in the annular area through laying flow. That's quite a bit.
What's the cement made of?
Regular, like, it's a different formulation than what you use for your patio.
Calcium carbonate. Also, another question, perhaps any of you could fill in. I was just wondering, I know that there was an Indigenous Peoples meeting today, and I was just wondering what the impact on the onshore facility and the offshore is to the local Indigenous Peoples as per this removal and decommissioning process for this particular platform.
We're not qualified in the proper space to answer that. I know that if those understanding the impacts of those operations and the potential for spill out there, and the spill that the discharge that happened on May 28th, I would encourage you to ask our representatives from the tribal communities those impacts that affected them and their tribes and their cultural resources. But I just don't feel comfortable speaking on their behalf. Understood. At this point.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add too, just real quickly, we did actually do, not like you were asking about concrete soundings, we did do casing analyses prior to laying the plugs. One of the things we were doing when we were cutting and recovering the 9-inch interior casing was actually doing some testing about the integrity of the exterior annuli casing. And the 13 3/8, we didn't find much. There were little bits and pieces here or there that could have been potential areas for a pathway for any kind of interaction to the annular spaces. But again, there wasn't anything super clear. And what we decided to do is what, like Jeff said, by taking out the nine inch production line or the production casing, we just filled the rest of the well basically with cement. And the whole point was to get it out into those annular spaces just to add additional coverage or if there was a conduit in that annular space for communication with some outside fissure or with the water that came in through the tides. So there were things that we were doing to assess the different casing string integrities, but we decided that part of laying the extra cement was a way of sort of doing more than was absolutely necessary, but it would also make the overall security of the well better. So, I mean, that was really kind of the basis for some of that extra cement.
And one thing I can add, and I mentioned it in the presentation, was whenever we'd open a valve at the wellhead, where that between that annular space, there would always be a little bit of trickle of water that would continue to come out. Once we put that first plug in, not only did that stop, but there was no pressure on any of the casings. So that's where our confidence lies, that I think we got it all.
Yeah. And the other part about the water that was, again, this is the kind of interesting, we'll call it a mystery of this 421, but the interesting part about the water was it was actually high chloride level water. This wasn't potable water. It wasn't coming up from an underground source of something else. So again, the salt water was some other interaction in that annular space. And the other part that's also really important about this, just for folks when you're thinking about the well, one of the things that Jeff really highlighted is that the production interval was the first thing plugged. There was no oil from an active reservoir that came up. This oil that was there either was in one of those natural fractures or, like Jeff said, some void outside of this. It was tested. It was fingerprinted. It was not the active oil from the production zone in the Vaqueros. It was something else. It could have been old Vaqueros oil, but decades old. Sort of sitting in a space that it hadn't had a chance to interact with. And when our teams were doing they were flushing parts of the well above where the cement had been set, which was in the production zone, that water interacted and either displaced oil or pushed it out of a void it had been sitting in. We're not entirely certain. What we can tell you, though, is that oil was coming into the well cellar around the well before we did any work. Yeah. There was something pushing oil up into the concrete portion of the caisson in the well cellar without anybody being on the well or doing any work. We actually had to clean out that well cellar twice prior to doing a lot of the work that we did on 421 too. So from some interesting area, oil was coming up. We knew it wasn't coming up through the main production zone, you know, on the well bore. It was coming from somewhere else. And again, the interaction with that natural fracture that ran of the Monterey that runs up under the caisson and was a conduit for oil to escape outside the caisson was very interesting. And just through sort of testing, like when Jeff said we did coring, we did multiple cores of the soil inside of the caisson, which is the big concrete structure that you all see out there. And we expected to find, based on the spill or the release, this body of oil that was sitting down in there. We didn't find that. As Jeff said, there was old oil in the soil, but it was bound up. It wasn't free oil. So again, as far as like the primary source for the oil that came out of this release, it's really not clear. And it could have been just water interacting with a natural location, a natural fracture system, or it could have been, like I said, oil that was displaced that had been out there for a very long time. But the chemical fingerprinting on this that was done identified that this wasn't live oil. This wasn't, you know, from the production zone as it set. And, you know, we're not entirely sure about every aspect of it. It was controlled But the final closure part of this was, as Jeff said, when the work was done, there was no pressure on any of the annuli, no pressure on the casing. Everything was secure, and we knew we had a good completion.
And as I told our tribal partners, this is a 90-year-old well. and our history of this well, maybe in the last 50 years. So there's like a 40-year interval there where we have no idea what they did, what they were doing, or where the oil was coming from, or where it was going. So, you know, it could have been from any of those operations. We just don't know. But we sealed it.
Yeah.
So.
We killed it good.
Plug 30 barrels from inside.
And of course, any fractured cameras may be pushed out and squeezed out there with sole purpose to isolate and to confine it to the reservoir.
I just want to remind everyone, this is being televised and recorded, and so if anyone has a comment, we ask you to please come to the mic so that this can be heard by everyone and record it for later. Thank you.
And Pat, come on up and take a seat.
For the audience watching at home, we were just talking with... a dog representative who was making the point that you can go to the conservation website and their well finder feature, and you can look into the daily reports for the wells, and you can literally see the field notes from the Dogger engineers. And the website is going to be conservation.ca.gov, and then you'll be able to go to Dogger under that, Dogger Well Finder, and you can use a map function, or if you need to find the actual well number, you can look. We can help you with that too. I know. we're not talking about the change name aspect right now, but it is changing. But if you go to conservation.ca.gov, you can get a significant amount of information, and you'll see the Well Finder program pretty much right off of the front page. And you can get those well reports if you're interested in looking a little bit more into it. But it does have good notation for the work that was done.
Hi, good evening. My name's Chris Chimette. I work for a company called Santa Barbara Mariculture. His name is Bernard Friedman. He has a farm off of Hope Ranch, and he doesn't know I'm here. Okay, so I'm speaking on my own. I work on the farmer's market on Saturday on Coda Street. And like Omar Sharif said, I'm a river to my people. We bring in between 100 to 150 pounds of mussels on a Saturday. We bring in about 300 oysters. He harvests on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So the mussels at the market are less than 24 hours old on Saturday. They're fresher than your first boyfriend or your first girlfriend. They're really fresh. It's local, low carbon footprint. It's a no carbon footprint. Yeah, it's just a few miles away. the great thing about mussels is that 3 ounces of mussel meat will give you 24 to 25 grams of protein. And we have a lot of kids out at UCSB that are food poor, or whatever the word is, verbiage is for that, because they're all at Costco buying Top Ramen by the cases. I come in contact with a variety of these kids, and I tell them what to do. For $5 a pound, you could split that pound in half. You could add some tomatoes to it, some pasta to it, and have a lot of good nutrients and get better grades in school because of the protein value. The ocean's a big place. What we have great here is we have a confluence of two currents. We have the Alaskan current comes down from up north, nutrient rich. We have the Mexican current comes down, mixes off of Point Conception. If anybody's ever dove out at the islands, you can see how rich the nutrients are out there. We have a lot of great upwelling. This is a unique place to grow shellfish. And what I would like to do if we keep this rig is I went to a school in Pasadena for commercial photography called the Art Center College of Design, and they also have product design, and they have a bunch of kids there from all over the world that design things from medical products to cars. The Miata was made there, the PT Cruiser, but also environmental and project designs. And you could come down there, and my visionary goal is that because of the infrastructure of this rig and the way it's settled, you could set a series of substrate lines that could go with the flow, and you could grow various things like kelp. You could grow, there's about 2,300 species of kelp that are edible, that have protein. You could have scallops. You could grow periwinkles. You could grow barnacles, create new protein, and it's would be a little bit of a cultural thing for some people who've never eaten them. I remember my first time, I was 8 years old at Joey DeLuca's house, and I sat at the table and said, hey, Joey, we're eating bait. And his father hit me upside the head, said, Chris, shut up, eat. Because we used to smash it and use it to go fishing for flounder. So it's a viable platform. I would hate to see it removed. I know everybody's got different ideas, but this is just kind of like my idea that we could grow quite a bit of sustainable food that we could support our community with. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope you stay engaged in our process as we move forward.
I hope to be here. Thank you.
Hi, Ray Furman. Stingray Sensing is my company. I just wanted to build on this wonderful presentation from one of Bernard's employees. My vision has been to turn Platform Holly into a kelp farm. I think that bivalves are also a really potentially valid option. Looking at both using it as an aquaculture facility as well as a research facility for UC Santa Barbara. I would love to put the onus upon UC Santa Barbara as opposed to the state of California, which doesn't, I mean, it is the same, but it doesn't, you know, there isn't a specific entity that really has the capacity to manage this facility. As it is, it has a biorefinery, which could be converted into a facility that could convert seaweed into biofuels and other types of things that could replace oil products. We could then use the existing infrastructure to pipe the seaweed onshore, liquefied seaweed, and use that again to replace various oil products, make it into a biofuel, biofertilizer, cosmetics, bioplastics. All of these are possibilities. The excellent aspect of Holly is that it is in shallow enough water to turn it into an aquaculture farm. So we've seen a lot of this in the Gulf of Mexico, the Rigs to Reefs program, which has been discussed at many meetings here previously. But I haven't seen anybody actually come up and talk about turning Holly into an aquaculture facility. I think that that is one of the best possible opportunities. At the last meeting, there was a consulting company that came forward with an idea to turn this into a wind farm. I think that there are a number of issues with that in terms of the visual plights that a number of community members will have an issue with. When you make it into an aquaculture facility, all of the visual issues go away because everything is below the sea. So that's a really an additional benefit. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Cool.
Thank you for that. And I think that this is a good time to also mention our other decommissioning project is Rincon Island. The plugging and abandonment work associated with that operation is a little bit farther along than at Platform Holly. And so we are looking at beginning the CEQA process for the disposition of the island next year. So that's another area that folks that are interested in how we might look at the future disposition of these offshore facilities might want to weigh in and make their voices heard. So keep an eye out for that too.
Hi, my name is Kevin Duffy. I'm a local Goleta resident. I've got a couple questions about water. The water that is used in your operations, do you source that as a Goleta water customer from the same Goleta water company that we buy it from? Do you have your own do you pump from your own wells? Where does the water that you use in your operations come from? How much have you been using? And will we be able to look forward to an abundance of water available because you are not using that water anymore? Please feel free to comment on your fresh water usage, historical, present, future.
Most of the water.
The reason I bring that up is as a Goleta resident, I mean, this is all happening right on top of Elwood Mesa.
The eucalyptus grove
has about died off because of the drought. A lot of talk has been about what can we do to help Elwood Mesa? What can we do to help bring back the wildlife habitat? Boy, with a lot of water, we can do a lot of stuff. We might even be able to restore the ancient oak forest that once was on top of Elwood Mesa. What a great dream that would be. But it all takes water. So I think this is an important concept. Please.
Let me see if I understand. Are you asking us how much water will be available when we're done?
Or if you have any knowledge of what you've been using, that could tell us what we might have available at the terminus of your operations.
Okay, so most of the water that we use out there is actually seawater.
Okay.
We have a lot of non-potable water that's used out there. Actually, just right now, we're starting to get more out there because we need it for cement and stuff. But that's all non-potable water. The actual freshwater,
Larry? You say non-potable, that's seawater or from some other source, sir?
You want to help me out here? You're the one that takes it out there. And
Hi, Larry Huskins with Beacon West. I help operate. So from a freshwater perspective, as Jeff alludes, most of the well activity is all done with seawater. Okay. So that's sourced at the platform. Other operations like cementing on the platform is fresh water is brought out on the boat that you saw in the picture, and that's brought from the Port of Wainimi.
Volume?
I don't know a specific volume. That would be a question maybe. I don't know, Steve, whether you have any answers on volumes. We haven't got into this yet.
We'd have to look it up. Yeah, it's not at our fingertips. I mean, there is water that's used, and there's water totes.
The ship travels into Port Wainimi, and then it loads the water at the port facility there. Not your water, no. It's not Goleta water at all. So the facility here at Elwood uses water for firewater activities. So if we're doing a drill with firewater or things like that, they'll use a little bit of water for that. Otherwise, it's very minimal fresh water that's used at the facilities.
Okay. How about when you were operating the piers? Was there ever fresh water usage at that time?
No significant volume. You are correct. We are on the Goleta City Water District's facilities. But the amount of volume is quite minimal. So occasional washdowns and things like that. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, Larry.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, ready to keep.
Yeah. I know it's getting a little bit late, so we're happy to close it down if there aren't any more questions, but we want to make sure that everybody has a chance. You can always talk to us after on an individual basis. You have our contact information up there, so please don't hesitate to reach out if you have any burning questions or want to talk anything through as we move forward.
And this presentation should be up on our website in the next day or two.
Yep. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah.